And what made you guys decide to do sort of like a separate study on the Black Triangle UFOs?
Well, it basically fell across the desk, and once we had published the results of the Illinois sighting, it became sort of commonplace for people to start reporting sightings of these mysterious black triangles on to our website, and we got hundreds and hundreds of reports. So it was not by design that we jumped into the black triangle thing. And people started contacting us. People started reporting these incidents.
Yeah.
We actually opened a hotline, and we got you know, literally hundreds of different incidents from around the country, and we interviewed all of the people involved. In some cases, you know, 17 to 20 eyewitnesses, for example. There was another famous one in Carteret, New Jersey in 2001 that we investigated. We interviewed about 20 separate eyewitnesses, and we triangulated the sighting. But in general, I think the so-called Skinwalker Ranch became what was and continued to be a pretty unique area where a laboratory of these unusual incidents could be set up and studied very, very closely, because that's one of the holy grails, really, in this kind of research is to really focus as deeply as possible and gather as many data as possible on as many incidents as possible, and that's what we did in Utah. And the results that came out of it, as we published in this book, was a bewildering variety of different incidents that spanned all across the field of cryptozoology, paranormal, ghost hunting, ufology. All of these phenomena have been divided neatly into different categories, and what was really astounding about the Utah experience was that these boundaries seemed to be totally irrelevant to what was unfolding on the property in Utah. It was one moment it was cryptozoology, the next moment it was these weird flying objects, including these large black triangles. The next moment it would be silver discs or Mexican hat-shaped UFOs, and next minute would be cattle mutilation. So it seemed to be a Grand Central Station where multiple incidents erupted. And as we mentioned in the book, there's been a traditional sort of separation between these disciplines. Cryptozoologists don't usually study UFOs, and nuts and bolts ufologists don't usually study Bigfoot, and you know, ghost hunters tend to keep their distance, and people who are into discarnate voices and hauntings and poltergeist activity tend to view the whole UFO subject with disdain. And so there's these multiple camps in these esoteric areas that are completely separate. But the Utah Ranch, the so-called Skinwalker Ranch, had the effect of uniting all of these. And we were in a position of having either to throw out the data or else include all of the data. And we were determined to keep an open mind on this whole project and to recount, to document all of these incidents as closely as possible and not throw anything out because they didn't fit into a particular pigeonhole. You know, just because in exactly the same area of the property, a flying object had been witnessed a week before, where this week there was a dead cow that had obviously been sliced up, then was there a connection between these two incidents? We have no way of knowing, but there was certainly a geographical connection in that they had happened right on the same spot in the same area of the property. We still have no idea of whether or not there was a temporal or a cause and effect connection between these kinds of disparate incidents, or was it some kind of an attractor, sort of a geographical attractor, for whatever reason this particular property was attracting all this weird stuff. I should also mention that this ranch is located in an area of northeastern Utah that has had at least a 50-year history, possibly even longer, of a whole variety of bizarre flying object incidents, UFO incidents going back to about 1950, 1951. The reason we know that is that way back at that time, the local science teacher in the local high school began to collect the reports that were coming in from the local population, and he was he had sufficient credibility in the local community that he was able to collect these incidents and keep confidentiality. So he accumulated over the years hundreds and hundreds of high quality reports. And the ranch is located exactly in the center of that whole area that had been subject to all this weird activity since the early 1950s. Now, whether or not the incidents that were happening on the ranch were a good snapshot of the incidents that were happening elsewhere, we don't know, because we know that this retired school teacher had collected so many different incidents over time that he began to skew the collection method towards only the most spectacular sightings of flying objects. Because his feeling was he could spend all day, every day interviewing people regarding all of the different weird things that had happened to them in this area of Utah. He decided to skew his investigation only towards the most spectacular multiple incident sightings of UFOs. So a lot of the stuff that had happened on the property had also happened in different areas of Utah, but it just simply were not reported.
Now, like, you just spoke to the sociological aspects of the different sects of research in esoterica, and that sort of speaks to the only real skeptical argument I've heard from anyone is that they sort of just shut down when they hear about all the incidents, and they say that's too much for one thing.
Right.
Have you heard that sort of argument from people before?
Definitely, yes, and it's curious because it really, I think, is severely dependent on the amount of time that you spend in a given location, and it is dependent on the amount of trust that local people have. Over the years, we did gain a lot of trust from the local inhabitants, and we were able to get from them a lot of the kinds of incidents that had happened to them. And there was a lot of overlap with what had happened on the ranch. So when people say it's too much, you know, it may be just a matter of the fact that they have not spent enough time investigating a particular property, you know, weeks or even months at a time. So we actually saw exactly the same thing in northern New Mexico. We arrived, we began investigating. The first thing we heard was a bunch of strange UFO incidents, but the deeper we began to dig, the more and more incidents that began to emerge, and you know, people were sort of less willing to come up front with a lot of strange incidents than they were sort of to recount sort of the usual UFOs flying over. But the deeper you dug, the weirder the incidents became as the trust was built up. So we think that there was probably a factor in that. In many of these so-called hotspots around the country, if you spend a lot of time digging, you find a lot more than you originally encounter.
Yeah. Now, Robert Bigelow, he bought the ranch. Was the NIDS project sort of like a side thing for him? The main question is, did he ever go to the ranch? Did he ever go and check it out himself? Or was it sort of like this is a side, like an R&D type thing for his enterprise?
Oh, he spent weeks literally on the ranch conducting night watches with
oh, wow.
Staff. You know, I mean, he was right hands on the property. He was up there with night vision binoculars till 4 or 5 a.m. watching just like everybody else. He was totally captivated by all of these you know, the scientific way of looking at this, because that's why he funded this whole thing was to see if he could get some answers to these unusual phenomena. So he was not kind of a remote figure that was sort of off doing other stuff. He was very much involved with the property, very much involved with the research, and on a daily basis, he was either calling people or we were calling him based on incidents if he couldn't actually be there. So he was a very hands-on research guy.
Yeah. All right. What do you say to the people who are like, Well, obviously, in the esoteric field, there's always a want for money, pretty much. Everybody needs money to do their research. And what do you say to the critics who are like, why won't he spend money on my developing research? Do you ever get people who say that kind of thing?
Well, we got numerous, applications for funding from everybody from the SETI people, the so-called Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence people. We got almost weekly requests for various funding of various projects. And what we did in response to some of these requests was we actually did investigate some of these, but on NID's terms. In other words, Robert Bigelow did fund some of these research projects, but NIDS had to be involved in the research because we weren't just going to throw money at at these kinds of idle sort of requests for money without making absolutely sure that there was a good business case to be made in terms of return on investment. That may sound sort of harshly business-like, but NIDS was run completely professionally as a business organization. You know, individual time was accounted for, individual effort was accounted for. So there was none of this kind of let's throw $10,000 at this person who wants to set up some kind of a monitoring station somewhere. If we were going to be involved, certainly financially, we were going to be involved physically too.
Yeah. Now, like as you allude to in the book, the activity at the ranch sort of tapered down. Is that what factored in you guys' decision to release the book now? Because, like you said before, you weren't really interested in publicity, and now obviously with this book, you're going to have to pay extra for security up there.
Well, the main driver for actually publicizing this was George Knapp, who co-wrote the book.
Yeah.
Because in 2002, he's had a long, long-standing relationship with Robert Bigelow that even precedes the formation of NIDS. And so what he wanted to do was to go on the record, if possible, with some of the incidents on the property and in 2002. And we agreed to it because we thought it would be a good way of finding out from the feedback to this publicity the numbers of other hotspots around the country.
Oh, yeah.
Indeed, around the world. So we did it with our eyes open, knowing that there would be an increase in publicity, which is exactly what happened. So we got a lot of feedback. George Knapp wrote two articles in the local Las Vegas newspaper that, you know, they were called Path of the Skinwalker, and they really went around the world, literally went around the world. Our website was getting, you know, thousands of hits from all around the world. So subsequent to that, George was the main driver in saying, and Robert Bigelow did agree to this, that some of the events could be described in book form. And this is really a sort of a personal narrative of my time and George's investigative time on the on this property over the span of the research project. Now, NIDS does still exist. It is on ice, but if there is any major resurgence in the kinds of activity that we were exposed to in 1996 and 1997, 1998, then you know, new people would be hired, and the whole thing would be revived. But the property still exists. It is still ongoing activity at a much lower level, but you know, and it is still under surveillance. So the same thing applies to people who are thinking of encroaching on the property as it did back in 1996, 1997. They are not welcome.
You heard that, people. Don't show up there. You said the point of the book was to get feedback. So far, obviously, the book's only been out for like 2 months, maybe 3 months now. What would you say about the feedback you've gotten so far? How's it shaped up?
Well, the feedback has been enormous, actually. It's been on all sorts of email lists. It's been sold out on Amazon.com a couple of times. It's been
nice.
It's actually in its second printing now.
Oh, wow.
Already, and it only came out on December 6th, which is So a lot of copies people are really interested in finding out what exactly happened on this property. So, yeah, it's doing really well, and we've got a lot of interesting feedback from different folks. Now, you know, there's a lot of people who are talking about similar incidents that have happened, and it's becoming really obvious that the ranch may not be as unique as people have talked about.
Yeah. Now, at the end of the book, you go through a variety of scenarios that may have been the source of the activity at the ranch. Where are you sort of leaning yourself personally? What do you think? Interdimensional type of situation?
Well, one of the things that Tom Gorman used to talk about all of the time was this peculiar thing that he used to see about a mile from where he lived. And this was still on the property. This large orange object would appear out of nowhere, and he took to spending a lot of time out on his property looking at this orange object.
Yeah.
And occasionally with a scope, he would look into this orange object, and he told me on a couple of occasions he saw like a different sky, different shape, a different color sky through the scope, through this orange object.
Wow.
And he figured it was some kind of a different world out there. We never actually saw that. We only saw the different phenomena. As I mentioned, you know, the Gorman looking through the scope, this rifle scope at what was in the orange hole. On one occasion, he actually saw through the scope this black object that was obviously moving quickly from this other side, so to speak.
Yeah.
Moving in his direction. He could see it against the clear blue sky, and as it moved in his direction, it was getting bigger and bigger, and it was moving extremely quickly. He lost it once it transited into the darkness from where he was, but it came from what looked like a bright sky, you know, from as he looked through it.
Yeah.
So he figured, you know, maybe that was some kind of evidence for something, you know, to do with different dimensions or different realities. Whether or not that explains all of the events, we don't have enough evidence to really pinpoint.
Yeah.
But, you know, the dimensional explanation is certainly an attractive one, in that, you know, where did all of these weird animals come from that were tracked on that property?
Yeah.
You know, Gorman used to talk about these incredibly brightly colored tiny birds that were more like tropical birds that appeared and disappeared. There were these large wolves that were on the property that were seen not only by the Gormans but by neighbors. And there was a variety of different animals that NID staff encountered that were actually shot at on a number of occasions. And there were no blood, no tracks kind of thing. So where did those animals come from? We really have no way of knowing, because there was so little physical evidence left on the ground following something like that. The exception being, of course, the dismembered calf that I talked about, and
yeah,
occasionally there were other animals mutilated on the property too.
Now, when in your time out there, what was the single like freakiest moment for you where you were like, this is paranormal, man, this is crazy? What was the scariest thing for you?
I think in June 1997, when myself and this physicist were standing out on the property, we were right out in the middle of this small pasture where previously, the previous week, a really spectacular series of infrared images had been photographed in this small pasture. And so we were staking the place out to see if we could recapture some of those, if anything was going to happen.
Yeah.
We would capture on infrared film. So this was about midnight. It was June. It was completely quiet. This place is so isolated. You know, it's the only thing you can see is the night sky, really. Everything else is just black around the place. So about 70 to 100 feet to our left, suddenly, out of nowhere, the whole place lit up. This basketball-sized object that was bluish-white was hovering about 15 feet off the ground. It was emitting this intense blue-white light, showed up on the ground, and it was just hovering there. It seemed like it was bouncing slightly, and then 5 seconds later, it just suddenly disappeared. So we had these law enforcement type flashlights that are, you know, that we can light up the whole pasture instantly. Yeah. So we slammed them on and ran over to the spot. There was absolutely nothing there. There was no evidence anything had happened. So we were kind of definitely in alert mode at that stage. So we went back to the original spot, shut off the spotlight, that the flashlights, and resumed operation. So the physicist with me had a set of ITT night vision binoculars, which are ambient light enhancement binoculars, and he was scanning the perimeter of the field. I was focusing on. I had a camera with infrared film. The idea was to try to get infrared shots like the investigator had done previously in that same spot. So physicists started reporting that right in front of him was there was a bank of trees about 100 feet right in front of us. He started reporting this big black amorphous, it almost looked like a cloud, was in the tree line moving within the trees, blocking out all the stars behind as he was looking through his infrared binoculars. Now, standing right beside him, I started taking these infrared photographs, see if we could record anything.
Yeah.
But the physicist became very agitated. He said that something had interfered with him, had locked onto his brain, how he described it later. But that some voice was telling him that he was being watched, or we were being watched. So remember, this was out in the black of night.
Oh,
we were sort of standing totally defenseless with whatever was in the darkness 100 feet ahead, basically informing this NASA physicist who was, the guy was not prone to fantasy, that he was being watched. Naturally, you know, he started getting very agitated. So he then reported this thing moving through the trees slowly. It began to collapse in on itself, is the way he described it, and gradually just kind of vanished. So during that whole period, I was taking these long exposure infrared photographs, and eventually, you know, when we developed the film, there was very, very little you could see on the phone. Certainly nothing you could really analyze with any confidence. So that was one of the incidents, because it really sort of drove it home how completely defenseless we were out there in the middle of nowhere. We did obviously have a system of backup if there was any real trouble, but it was definitely a spooky incident.
Now, do you find, like, you lived through that situation and everything, but did you find it frustrating then when you tried to, like, to produce some kind of evidence, but it was never really forthcoming? Like, but you obviously, you experienced it, you know what's going on there, so is it frustrating?
Well, we found it obviously very frustrating because, the basic premise of a scientific investigation is to gather evidence and gather evidence that's reproducible. So when you're in a situation where none of the variables are controlled, when you have no way of being at the right place at the right time, you've no way of controlling any part of the experiment, you're basically at the mercy of something that is out there. You've no idea what it is. So that part of the whole investigative process became very frustrating, because we were, as the book title says, Hunt for the Skinwalker, we were hunting something. We didn't know what it was. We knew that it had terrorized this family for 20 months. We knew that all of these incidents were happening on our watch. You know, we were constantly chasing something that was ephemeral. It was transient. It was, you know, that we could not get our teeth into it. It always seemed to be one step ahead of us, and it displayed some parts of this whole trickster mentality or trickster category that a lot of the Native Americans talk about, and in that it is totally unexpected, it is never predictable, and it's almost we got the feeling at times that it was almost toying with us.
Yeah.
And that may have been our sort of our way of interpreting what was happening, but there did seem to be this whole trickster phenomenon that was going on. So yeah, from a scientific perspective, it was a very, very frustrating cat and mouse game because, you know, we had the psychology of we're going after this thing, we're going to capture whatever we can on film, we're going to write it up, we're going to document it, and hopefully we're going to publish a paper on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was our perspective, and this whatever this was on the property was not cooperating in any way.
Now, I'm always interested in what the perspective of the people who are featured in a book, like after it comes out, did Tom Gorman or his wife or his kids or anything, did they read the book? Have you heard from them post-publication of Hunt for the Skinwalker?
Not so far, but we did make a promise to the family to protect the family as much as humanly possible from any publicity. So we changed their names.
Yeah.
We altered certain parts of their background and that kind of thing to make sure that people would not start to try to track them. Even though, you know, there was a publicity about them in 1996, and people who were diligent enough will probably be able to track back, get their original names, etc. But our promise to the family was, look, we are not in any way interested in disturbing your peace of mind. So the idea is not to contact the family and to let them live their lives. They want to put this whole thing behind them. They were terrorized and they were traumatized by something they don't understand. But, you know, they've been living a life in another state for many, many years. They've had no recurrence of these incidents, and they want to just get on with their lives because not only were they terrorized on their property, but the local community where they were living in northeastern Utah didn't take particularly kindly to this this sudden upsurge in bizarre wild stories that was centered in their small community. They're a very private community in northeastern Utah, very religious, and you know, they're not really too keen on a lot of media attention.
Yeah. Final question, really. What's next for you, and then NIDS in general?
Well, I think NIDS is going to be reactivated when and if it's deemed that there's enough activity to really really get the research, serious research, into. From my perspective, I'm now currently employed in the biotechnology industry. My background is in molecular biology and in biochemistry. So I'm back doing what I was doing before this project came up way back in 1996. So,
oh, wow.
I'm obviously extremely interested in looking at all of these esoteric subjects, but I'm not particularly interested in spending the rest of my life full-time exploring these topics because our experience at the Skinwalker Ranch was that the more you chase something like this, the more opaque it becomes. So these kinds of topics, from my perspective, you can spend a whole lifetime and really get nowhere.
Yeah. Yes, it's just better to not watch the pot, and then it'll boil, sort of thing.
Exactly, exactly.
And the book is available, like you said, via Amazon.com. Is it in the bookstores too, Barnes & Noble, Borders?
Yeah, it's in Borders, Barnes & Noble. It's in bookstores nationwide.
Awesome.
In many cases, as I mentioned, it's been sold out, so if it's not there when you go there, you know, you can certainly order it.
Yeah,
Amazon.com. There's also our website, huntfortheskinwalker.com, which is, you know, it's got some added information there, and also some of the photographs, that kind of thing from the property. So it's an interesting read.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It was a really good book. I enjoyed it a lot. I whipped right through it like in 3 or 4 days, and it's just chilling at times. It's frightening. It's exciting. It's like you said, it's a hunt, and you're sort of in on the hunt. And I really enjoyed it a lot. I highly recommend it. I have a feeling many of the listeners have already read the book because everybody was talking about it since December when it came out, and hopefully those who are sitting on their duff will have gone out and picked it up and check it out. And do you have an additional website that you want me to mention?
I do have the website on the Mad Cow Brain Trust book, which is www.colmkelleher.com, C-O-L-M-K-E-L-L-E-H-E-R.
And are you going to do any more Mad Cow stuff in the future, you think?
Yeah, I'm very interested in this whole subject, and I think as time goes on and this whole link between chronic wasting disease and humans eating potentially contaminated venison is an additional layer of complexity onto the mad cow situation that already is here in North America. So I'll be keeping a close eye on that too.
Awesome. Maybe in the future I can have you back and we'll talk about that. Thank you very much, Colm Kelleher, for appearing on Banal America Audio. It was a great interview, and I appreciated you giving me the time to talk about the book. The book is Hunt for the Skinwalker. As he said, it's available nationwide. Pick it up. Read it. You're going to love it. Colm Kelleher, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Colm Kelleher for stopping by and being on the show. You can find out more information on Colm Kelleher at www.colmkelleher.com. That's C-O-L-M-K-E-L-L-E-H-E-R.com. And you can find more information about the book at www.huntfortheskinwalker.com. And that's HuntfortheSkinwalker.com. Big thanks to Leslie and Chiron of BanalofAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series, and big thanks to R. Lee of BanalofAmerica.com, one of our newest columnists. She's been on board for about 6 weeks or so here at BanalofAmerica.com, and she's been a great help with the audio series as well, so thank you, R. Lee. And, of course, I want to thank all the great listeners out there who have found us worldwide. I'm getting emails from all over the world. It's really amazing, and I'm seeing links to Banal of America Audio posted all over the internet, and it's just amazing, and I really appreciate it. You can find daily updates, sometimes twice a day, on rare occasions three times a day, updates at banalofamerica.com. Columnists Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, they put out weekly columns. They are amazing stuff. You've got to check those out. I, of course, write the Banal Report and a couple other columns and feature articles at banalofamerica.com. If you are just discovering us, definitely check out the website. If you have been a frequent listener and you haven't had a chance to check out banalofamerica.com, please do so. You will love it, I'm sure. And that you can find at www.binnalofamerica.com. I would be remiss in not mentioning that we have a PayPal button up for donations for folks who want to throw some change in the bucket and help Banal of America Audio keep rolling on down the line. You can click the PayPal button, you can make a donation, and it would help offset some of the expenses that we incur as we produce this remarkable audio series that you have come to know as Banal of America Audio. Next week, we've got Steve Bassett. He's the founder of the Paradigm Research Group, founder of the X Conference. He's a lobbyist on the UFO issue. He ran for Congress in 2002 on the UFO ticket. He is a key figure in the disclosure movement now. He will be on Banal of America Audio to talk about the Paradigm Research Group, being a lobbyist on the UFO issue, his 2002 Congress run on the UFO ticket. We're going to talk all about that. We're going to talk about the X Conference, what it's like to set it up, the business aspects of it. We're going to talk about the big stories in exopolitics for 2005, the Hellyer story, the Brazilian disclosure story, some of the India Daily stories, that strange trend coming out of India, and tons more, and that's just the first installment. This is a massive interview, spanned over 3 hours. It'll be broken up into 2 weeks, as we do for our big ones. Next week, we'll be talking about all that stuff I just talked about. In 2 weeks, even more stuff. I'll preview that next week. It's going to be Steve Bassett next week on Banal of America Audio, February 11th, 2006. Until you hear from me then, thanks for listening, folks. This is Tim Banal, signing off.